Z-Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 351. Friday, December 13th, 2019. Uh-oh. Friday the 13th.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, KMO here, and I am going to play for you a conversation that started in a YouTube video and then, you know, continued with the express intent of placing it here in the vault. It is with Michael O. Varhola. I will not attempt to encapsulate Michael's bio because he'll do it for us in the early part of the interview, and also because, well, it's long and impressive. But largely in this conversation, we're going to be talking about the series of lectures that he gave on a cruise recently, a cruise that went from Rome through the Suez Canal and ended up in Dubai. He was a paid lecturer. He addressed audiences. He basically stood on stage in the theater on a cruise ship and, you know, regaled audiences with information about the places and the peoples and the history of the region through which they would be sailing. The conversation detours off into other areas, and I do speak briefly with him about the two divergent paths of Star Wars. Every time I mention Star Trek or Star Wars, somebody feels the need to write to me to tell me that they don't like one of those two properties. I understand that some of you don't like them. You don't need to tell me. I would encourage you to imagine how you feel when, in talking about something you like, somebody makes a point of telling you that they don't like it. Do you feel closer to that person or more distant? As I say, the first part of this conversation was in a YouTube video. I suspect most of the people listening to this podcast have not seen the video, so I have included that portion of the conversation, though I have trimmed it a little bit just so that it flows and passes by more quickly. Not that it is, you know, poor content, but for those of you who did see the video, I'm going to minimize the repetition a little bit without sacrificing any of the content. And with that brief introduction, here's my conversation with Michael O. Varhola. Hey, Michael.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good. Good deal. Yeah, sorry. I got back at 1:30 on Friday morning, and I've been pretty much just playing catch up since then.
Got back from where?
Dubai, in this case.
Whoa, Dubai? What took you to Dubai?
Well, I got contracted to do a series of historical and cultural lectures on a ship sailing from Rome to Dubai.
Okay. I knew about the departure point, not the...
End point.
End point, right. Yes.
So it was an eventful couple of weeks, and then a couple of extra days in Dubai. But I was home for like 3 or 4 days after getting back from Hawaii, and then flew to Rome and just got, so I've been like moving for like 6 weeks, and I'm finally just home and just try to get caught up on stuff at the moment. So that's where I'm at right now.
Well, I'm going to ask you about juicy details from your travels in a bit, but okay. before we get into the podcast conversation, I want to do a quick bit for YouTube.
Okay. Terrific.
You have no idea what I'm about to ask you, right?
I have no idea what you're about to ask me.
Okay. I like Andrew Yang. He's my candidate in the Democratic primaries. And his signature policy, which is not really the thing that I really like about him, but, you know, it's what most people who are really into him are looking forward to, is his universal basic income policy, which he calls the freedom dividend. What's your opinion on the freedom dividend or universal basic income, whichever you have an opinion on?
I think it's a great idea. I grew up in Europe. There were always criticisms from Americans of these policies that they had in countries like the Netherlands, where people who claim to be artists could get $1,000 a month. All they had to do was pretend to be an artist and then make this crappy art that no one wanted, and the government was willing to pay them $1,000. And I guess the bottom line is societies subsidize the things that they think have value and which contribute to quality of life for their populations overall. And I would say that quality of life in countries like the Netherlands and other countries that have policies similar to the one that you described that Yang is pushing, I think they tend to be pretty happy with decisions like that. I think that if someone wants to pretend to be an artist and pretend to make art and is willing to subsist on $1,000 a month as their reward for pretending to do that, the fact that 1 in 10 or 1 in 5 or even 10 in 10 are actually going to be real artists and producing something of value, I think it is worth it for that to be the case.
Holy crap, Michael. Of all the people I've brought on, you're the first one who've said, yeah, it's a pretty good idea.
Well, I like to think that I also had a cohesive reason for why I think it's a good idea.
Well, you did. I think a big piece of it was your very first utterance, which was, I grew up in Europe.
Sure. Well, I grew up in a socialized society. I grew up in a society where everybody had income transparency, where everybody was assigned the school they would go to and assigned the house they would live in. And that socialized society was called the U.S. Army. I grew up on Army bases, and that was basically the socialized society that I grew up in. I think a lot of Americans would be surprised to hear that, the pro-military, anti-socialist Americans, to realize basically life in the military caste, life on a military base for military dependents, is very, very much a socialized society.
So now that I've gotten the much sought after but ever elusive answer of, yeah, we should actually support the things we value and we should value the happiness and quality of life of our citizens.
Well, I'm glad I could be the one that would step up and do that.
Now that you've provided that much sought after answer, who are you?
Who am I? Well, my name is Michael Ovarhola. I am variously a writer, editor, and publisher. I've written, depending on how you count them, about 17 books, and I'm counting those as books that have been published by people other than myself. And I've published something like 240 books that either I contributed to or other people wrote for me. So, and I have a background in journalism and as a U.S. Army infantryman and combat veteran.
And you didn't mention role-playing games anywhere in there.
Well, I'll mention role-playing games as long as I've just got an open mic here, as it were. My publishing company is called Skirmisher Publishing, and we do, in fact, publish role-playing games, historic reprints, fantasy fiction, a lot of science fiction things. Skirmisher's been around for about 17 years now, and we've published, I think, about 240 things in the last 17 years, though about 80 of them are two-page Geb comic strips that we published in the last year, which I am very pleased with. And the other thing I didn't mention is that I live in Texas Hill Country, about 40 miles north of San Antonio.
You have another gig. And this is the one that I want to talk to you about for the podcast. So we'll tease the video audience with it, and then we'll pop over into the, you know, the private chamber for the podcast.
Got it.
Tell me about your gigs on cruise ships.
Well, some years back, I discovered that cruise ships, the very best cruise ships, have lecturers on board who do educational or cultural lectures, often tying in with the itinerary. And that is something that I do. One of the dubious benefits of having written 17 books, many of which are travel guides or history books, is that it gives me a certain amount of credibility. So I pretty much as often as I want, more often than I want to in many cases, can land a gig on a cruise ship. on which I will give a series of lectures. And I'm the one that comes up with the lectures. I develop them. So I'll look at the itinerary and I'll see what ties in with my areas of expertise that I want to talk about. And I'll pitch however many lectures I need to give, one per sea day plus one for a weather day. And then I'll pitch an itinerary of 6 or 8 or 10 lectures. And if the cruise line accepts them, then I will get on that cruise ship, you know, whenever it sails, and I will be among the staff who are providing entertainment for passengers on board their voyage.
And you just did two of those trips almost back to back.
I really did do just two back to back. I did a 15-day cruise from Los Angeles round trip via 4 ports of call in Hawaii. And I did a series of lectures tying in with the history of the Pacific and Polynesian culture. And then I just got back on Friday morning, early Friday morning, from really what was about the best cruise I've ever been on as a lecturer. The passengers responded so well to the series of lectures I gave. But basically, I sailed from Rome to Dubai via the Suez Canal and did a series of lectures tying in with the history and culture and literature of the Mediterranean and Middle East. So I did a lecture called Sailing the Wine Dark Sea that was about the Odyssey and how it tied in with our itinerary. I did one on the gods and goddesses of ancient Greece and Rome. I did one on the gods and goddesses of ancient Egypt. I did one on the 7 wonders of the ancient world, all of which were within about 100 miles of where we sailed on this cruise. I did one on the 7 voyages of Sinbad, which I love because we were sailing through the Red Sea, which is where these stories are set when I gave the lecture. So it was a very rewarding experience in every way, suffice it to say.
So, you know, when I was a youngin', like third grade, I lived in Pleasant Hill, California, which is a suburb of San Francisco. And I went to see the movie Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger in the theater probably 4 or 5 times. Absolutely loved it. Yep. And I had an indulgent mother who would take me again and again. So I'd be very happy to talk about Sinbad. And also, was it you who was telling me that there's a theory that the Greeks couldn't see color, or they couldn't see the color blue, which is why Homer described the sea as wine dark?
I am not the one that told you that, but okay. Kevin ended up posting on my Facebook page in response to something, is it true that the Greeks were colorblind? So I bet that was him who said that. I'd never heard that before.
Oh, okay. So you can't confirm or deny. Not that anybody could confirm or deny, but you could cast a vote.
Well, you know what? If I could cast a vote, what I would say is there's probably some recessive gene that has turned up on a couple of Aegean islands that contributes to color blindness, partially or wholly, amongst some of the population. And that has led to some broader rumor that Greeks are colorblind. That would be my guess. But no, Homer referred to the wine dark sea because that is an extremely evocative phrase. Wine was so important in ancient Greece, and the whole idea that the sea could be viewed as a metaphor for this wine that connected Greek culture in so many ways, I think that's why he used that. What other thing that was so prevalent in Greek culture that was even vaguely reminiscent of the color of the sea could he refer to? Wine is the obvious choice of the thing that he would refer to. Tell me one thing that sounds nearly as good as wine dark sea and is more color correct. There isn't.
So I don't think occurs to me, I'll let you know.
That is not evidence that the Greeks were colorblind. Some of them might have been colorblind. I'm partially colorblind. But I cannot see how that literary convention is in any way indicative of that.
So you say you're a little bit colorblind. You've surely taken the test where somebody holds up a card and it's got a bunch of dots on it, and some of the dots are a different color so you can see a shape inside it?
Yeah, that's the test. And I took it when I went into the Army, you know, 33 years ago, or however many years ago it was. And yeah, I think I got 8 out of the 14 right. 14 is such a weird number to test anybody on, but I think I got 8 out of the 14 right and 6 out of the 14 wrong. And periodically, I'll respond to a color in a way that the people around me don't respond to. And they'll say, no, that's not really the color that you think you're describing.
When I was young and in my teens, I guess, I took one of those tests and I got all of them right. And, you know, they go from easiest to hardest. And on the last few, the doctor would hold up the card and I'd say the name of the letter or whatever was on it. And he'd look at the answer on the back. He'd say, yeah. And then he'd look at it himself. He's like, wow, I don't see that. Apparently I see color about as well as bees.
Well, the doctor was presumably older than you. And I think that the older we get, the more our senses in general degrade. So that was probably it. Probably when the doctor was your age, he probably would have seen that one just fine, would be my guess.
Well, it's my sense of smell that has deteriorated in my middle age.
Such as it is.
Well, back to the Mediterranean. When you start to prepare a lecture, I mean, you're looking at the itinerary of the cruise ship.
Yep.
How long are these lectures? Are they like an hour each?
Well, the lecture itself is usually anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes and has a PowerPoint presentation accompanying it. So a 40-minute lecture is going to have maybe 15 PowerPoint slides with it. So I don't overdo it on the PowerPoint slides. I don't try to use animations or embedded sound or a lot of text. It's usually a few evocative pictures. So if I'm talking about the Odyssey, if I'm talking about Odysseus being on the deck of his ship, tied to the mast, listening to the sirens sing while his crew rows away with wax in their ears. When I talked about that, I had a second century AD Tunisian mosaic that depicted that scene. So things that are evocative and colorful and show how people have responded over the ages to the things that I'm lecturing on. So the lecture itself is not a big deal because really I could find a canned script and I could just read it for half an hour on stage if that's all that was required. But I really make a point of being a subject matter expert in anything I talk about. So every lecture I give has about 40 hours of prep that goes into it. So the lecture itself has got about 40 hours of prep time of background reading and rewriting and creating the script and creating the PowerPoint, at least 40 hours. Sometimes it's considerably more than that. And then where you really have to be proficient is the Q&A. So I'll give a 30-minute presentation, structured presentation, but then I'll frequently have 20 or 30 minutes of Q&A that follow, and people will come up to the stage once the presentation is over and ask me more questions. People will accost me around the ship and ask me yet more questions. People want to meet for a drink. They'll want to meet for dinner. On this cruise, we did a roundtable discussion where I said, we haven't had time for a Q&A, so whoever wants to show up, meet me at this wine bar on board the ship. And I met with 12 or 15 people, and we talked for an hour and a half just about any of the things that I had lectured on that they wanted to discuss in further detail. So preparing for the lecture and giving the lecture is the easiest part. Preparing for the lecture is the second most difficult part, and actually being comfortable discussing the material in depth is really where it shows whether you really are an expert in the material in question. I have a background in journalism. In 30 days, I can become a subject matter expert in anything that is not completely technical in nature.
Right. So you mentioned 12 or 15 people showed up for the roundtable after the lecture. How many were at the lecture proper?
About 200 or 300 usually.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So they have like lecture halls that fit that many people?
They've got the theater on board the ship that they're using for the shows at night is my theater during the day. That's where I give my lectures. As my wife always says when she looks at it for the first time, well, I hope you can tap dance. And I can't.
Okay.
So yeah, two or 300 people normally. It depends. If they give it to me, if I get the 9 a.m. slot, I get fewer people. No. So there, there are ways that you can influence getting more or fewer people there. If it's on something that's really, really hot, Sinbad was hot, and my talk was like at 11 a.m. So, you know, that had 300 people showing up for it.
I read Voyages of Sinbad when I was a kid, and I'm having trouble remembering what came where, but it seemed that the stories were either ripping off something else or had been ripped off by somebody else, because I recognized the structure of several of the stories.
Well, the structure of the stories is a frame story structure. So the Seven Voyages of Sinbad are at least today, considered to be part of the 1001 Arabian Nights. So the structure of the 1001 Arabian Nights is that the princess Scheherazade is telling a story to her murderous husband, and she ends the story every night for 1001 nights on a cliffhanger, so that he can't have her put to death at dawn. He wants to put her to death, but her storytelling is so good, he's got to let her live till the next night. So she ends one story, starts another, ends it on a cliffhanger. She does this for more than 3 years, 1001 nights, or about 3 years. Sinbad is structured the same way. There is a poor porter, a baggage carrier, someone who carries things around the city of Baghdad, and he's going through a rich neighborhood in Baghdad, and he stops to take a break on a bench outside of a rich man's house, and he laments to Allah, you know, why is it that I, Sinbad the porter, have to work so hard, but people like the ones who live in this palace don't have to do anything to be so wealthy and lucky? And sitting inside is retired Sinbad the sailor, who sends his servants to bring this impertinent Sinbad the porter in. And he says, well, what a coincidence. We both have the same name, and I see that you're poor and you're complaining on my doorstep, but let me tell you why, through fate and fortune, I've become rich. And it's not just dumb luck and not to my merit at all. So then for 7 days, he tells his seven voyages to Sinbad the porter. So it's the frame story that you get from Scheherazade. So that's one of the things that might have resonated with you, the whole frame story structure. And then the other thing is, these stories were written, they were put into the form that we know probably in about the 12th or 13th century AD. So they were really a product of the Islamic medieval world. And they were really designed to project Islamic medieval values. And the reason that the character, the main character, they call him Sinbad the Sailor. He's not a sailor at all. He never sails anything. He's a merchant. He is a traveling merchant. He hires ships. He hires captains. He buys vessels. And then he travels from one place to another. So mercantilism and the merchant class was revered in this period of Middle Eastern culture and in this region. So that's why he's our archetypal hero. But these were literate people who wrote these stories, and many of the stories draw directly on earlier works like the Odyssey. So there is one episode where Sinbad and his men are trapped in the courtyard of a giant palace, and a giant comes every day and kills one of the men and roasts them and eats them. And the way they escape is by blinding the giant, making a raft, and sailing away from the island, which is really just the retelling of Odysseus and the Cyclops.
Right.
So a lot of the Sinbad stories will seem familiar because they've been picked up from something that was written 2,700 years earlier, give or take.
Remember the Sinbad movies? I mean, Eye of the Tiger was kind of a later one, but there was Seventh Voyage and The Golden Voyage.
Yep. Yeah, Seventh Voyage I just saw because they showed it on the ship. So the cruise director got Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. And I think that one was that's the 1958 one, I think. So that's one of the earlier ones. But yeah, there are a bunch of them. And I don't think any of them are completely accurate as far as the books are concerned. But the better ones are at least evocative of the themes in the books.
Now, I think it was the Golden Voyage where there was the sorcerer who had the little homunculus familiar that he used as a spy.
Right. I think that was the sorcerer? Golden. What's that?
You remember who played the sorcerer?
do I remember who played the sorcerer? Was it Jack Palance?
It was Tom Baker, aka Doctor Who.
Wow.
One of the curly hair and long scarf.
That.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat.
He's an actor. He's actually an actor.
Right, 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 right. Now, remember that that was one of the three. The 1958 one, which was Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, and then Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, and Golden Voyage of Sinbad. The, you know what those three had in common with each other?
Tell me.
They all had Ray Harryhausen animations.
Yeah, actually, it came to me just before you said it, but yes.
Right. It's almost a trick question for anyone who's seen them.
Right, because the actor's not the same in all three.
It's a different Sinbad, and a different evil sorcerer, and a different slave girl. That's different in all of them. The one thing that's the same are the Ray Harryhausen animations. That's right.
Who, for people who don't recognize the name, he is a pioneer in stop-motion animation.
Right.
So you'll recognize his stuff. I mean, it's very iconic. And of course, you know, well, he's gone now, but that art is largely gone as well because computers.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But I think one of the last things he did was Clash of the Titans.
Yep.
Which was, you know, right at the very tail end of where you could get away with that sort of animation on screen and audiences would just buy it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was when? That was, the 80s. Early 80s, I think, right?
It was early 80s. I was a kid. It might even have been the 70s, actually.
Yeah, late 70s, early 80s. He did the original Clash of the Titans. And then Jason and the Argonauts was in the 70s for sure. And then those three Sinbad movies and a few others.
Mm-hmm. There was an animated version of Sinbad. I think it was DreamWorks that did it in the 90s.
Yeah.
And Brad Pitt was Sinbad, or the voice of Sinbad.
Yeah, I guess the thing that sort of hacks me off about that one, that version of Sinbad, is that it is very, very untrue to the original. And when I say untrue, I don't mean that they deviated on a few details. I mean they set it in the Mediterranean, and all of the monsters and supernatural beings are basically drawn from Greek mythology. And that is not true to the Sinbad story cycle at all. They're not set in the Mediterranean. Because there was no way to get through easily to the Mediterranean in that era. There were a few. But for the most part, the stories of Sinbad were part of the Indian Ocean trade that had existed. So they take place in the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba, the Arabian Sea, the Persian Gulf, the Indian Ocean. They stretch from Egypt to China. But they don't extend northward or westward into the Mediterranean. So I think DreamWorks decided somewhat cravenly, well, it's tougher to sell Middle Eastern culture than Mediterranean culture. And they just sort of copped out and took the easy route.
And they couldn't have, you know, they had no reason to anticipate the sort of woke pushback they'd get today if they tried to cut those sorts of corners.
No, that's true. But on the other hand, there's at least as much or more antagonism between the Western world and the Middle East. So they might end up making the same decision today just to avoid getting the kind of popular, probably not backlash, but probably inaccessibility that they might have if they tried to do that again. So who knows?
You know, in Hollywood these days, it seems like anything that is familiar must be remade constantly. Like, there have been multiple King Arthur movies in recent years.
Right.
And who really cares about King Arthur? But it's, you know, it's a known character. It is known. So we're going to do it again.
Again and again and again. And you know what? I have mixed feelings on this. On the one hand, I really think it's legitimate for every generation to reinvent popular literary themes. I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all, because the millennial generation has got different expectations and different experiences than the baby boomers or the Gen Xers. So the idea that something would be remade with the tastes and expectations of the current generation in mind, I don't have a problem with that at all. I think that's what makes art dynamic and interesting. Where I start to have a problem with it is if the decisions are made for hackish reasons or purely economic reasons. If the what's driving the train is the idea that art needs to be reinvented to remain fresh, then I'm good with it. If what's driving the train is cheapness or greed or laziness, and honestly, it's usually not that hard to tell. It's usually not that hard to tell what has driven a particular decision on these things.
Well, what I was going to get around to was, you know, while we have, like, there's rarely a time without a new Batman, you know, Batman's already been recast and will be, you know, reincarnated shortly.
Yep.
We haven't seen a steady parade of Sinbad the Sailors.
No, we haven't. And I would like to see that. I would really love it if somebody were to take the true Sinbad the Sailor, as true as it can be. What's true by my accounting might be different than what would be true to a 9th century Persian, obviously. But what's true to me is the 19th century earliest English translation of Sinbad by Sir Richard Francis Burton, which is kind of off color and a little bit raunchy and somewhat violent. And when you read the Burton translation, it does not read like a kid's story at all. And that's something that I actually talk about in my lecture, that the Burton translation is much grittier and it's a lot more florid. And it tends to be about five times as long as some of the sort of abridged and sanitized versions that would be acceptable to kids or acceptable for kids. And I have no problem with Sinbad being turned into a kid's story. Kids need good stories. But it isn't just a kid's story. And the adult version of it is pretty dark and pretty gritty. And if somebody were to make an authentically, believably dark, gritty story, and you know what I'd love to see? I'd love to see Sinbad treated as merchant and not as a swashbuckler. He's called Sinbad the Sailor even in the original stories. He does kill people once in a while. He rises to the occasion and does things like blind giants or tie himself to the leg of a giant bird so he can escape, you know, from a mountaintop that he's trapped on. But he's not a swashbuckler. He's a normal guy that gets driven to do extreme things. And to me, that's just as interesting as somebody who's a professional swashbuckler. You're not a professional swashbuckler. I'm not a professional swashbuckler. What's interesting to a real audience is the idea that we might end up in a situation like a normal person and have to figure out how to survive it. And that's Sinbad. Sinbad's a normal guy who ends up in extraordinary situations and has to figure out how to get through them. And there's character development. He develops throughout these seven voyages. He gets harder and wilier as the seven stories evolve.
As one would expect.
As one would hope.
Well, one would expect of a story with a successful outcome.
There you have it. Yeah. So why are there seven voyages? Because he forgets after every voyage how much he suffered. He's still got a ton of money. He just gets bored. So he goes out on the next voyage and something horrible happens to him. And by the seventh voyage, he says, oh my God, I swear, if you let me survive this, God, I will never go on another voyage. So that's why there are seven and not eight, because in the seventh, he finally says, I'm going to forget when I get home how awful this was. So I'm just going to swear an oath that I'm never going to travel again.
But that's why he's Sinbad the Sailor, because he actually goes on the Voyagers. He's not.
This is true. Exactly.
He's not Sinbad the Underwriter, Sinbad
no,
the
Actuary, right.
Sinbad the Venture Capitalist.
That's right. 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 Sinbad the Silent Partner.
Yeah.
Right.
Those are dull movies.
Those are not fun movies.
You know, when I started, I went on this kick where I read a whole bunch of books on comedy writing. And so it's a hard thing to sort of encapsulate, you know, and different people who are successful at it sit down to write their books and they're very different and they, you know, contradict one another.
Yeah.
But one of the theories of comedy is, you know, a comic hero. This is Steve Kaplan's idea of what comedy is. It's a story about a character who is determined to do something or get something they want, but they don't have the necessary skills or the knowledge to get it, but they don't give up. And so self-destructive, determined, you know, clueless, these are all funny attributes.
Right.
The opposite
or at the opposite end of the spectrum, is the character who has all the skills, knows everything they need to know, totally calm, cool, and collected, and has every tool in the toolbox at the ready and can do anything. And that's a heroic character.
Right.
You know, that's James Bond. Or, you know, pick your character, but your heroic character who is somebody to look up to. You can have the exact same story, the exact same series of events, the exact same dynamics in play, everything. If you just take away all the skills and savoir-faire and capabilities of the hero, but, you know, crank up the determination of that main character, they become a comic character and it becomes a comedy.
I think there's something to be said for that. But I would say that the other side of the coin, and this is something I've noticed in a number of movies in particular, is that the hero that you describe sometimes can become a little cold and antiseptic because they do have their skills honed to such a degree. They can come off feeling like a bit of a technocrat. They can even come off feeling like a bit of a sociopath. Going back to Brad Pitt again, look at World War Z. His character there is highly proficient and probably sociopathic. He's a character who can do anything, does so only reluctantly and for reasons that normal people wouldn't respond to. His character doesn't respond to things for heroic reasons or altruistic reasons. He contacts his military friends and says, you need to save my family. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, we need you to save the world. And he says, no, I don't think so. And he basically has to have his arm twisted to save the world. Is that a hero, or is that somebody who just happens to be really, really, really good at things? Who are the heroes? All the people that he sacrifices like pawns for
the nameless people. Who ride by his side for a few seconds before they get engulfed by zombies.
They're the heroes. He's not a hero. He's just somebody who is preternaturally good at things. But seriously, who watched that movie who could say, I identify with this guy. I'm that good at that. Most people aren't even any fucking good at their normal jobs. Most people look forward to their stupid lake vacations or going to amusement parks because they despise their own work so much. The whole idea that they're good enough to save the world, they can't identify with a hero like that. Whatever made people like that movie, they didn't like it because they identified with the hero. And I think that's the problem with love Daniel Craig, love James Bond, but sometimes he starts to push the boundaries of what I'm talking about too. The hero becomes inaccessible.
The writer's antidote to that is, though, right?
What's that?
You know what the writer's antidote is to that that distant, sort of aloof protagonist who's too good at everything?
Tell me.
The sidekick.
Oh, well, this is true. Yeah, yeah.
You give him a humbling or very flawed or, you know, very humble or just, you know, somebody who is not that. But
or something that incorporates a comedic element, like you were saying, that brings the hero down a notch.
Or, you know, gives the audience somebody they can connect with better, like, you know, Dr. Watson. Because Holmes is that technocrat.
There you have it. Yeah, and that's a really good example. The best example for me, though, the hero who does fail. The Greeks nailed it. Odysseus is the protagonist of the earliest still existing book in the Western literary tradition, the book that set the standard for so much of what was to follow. And he makes mistake after mistake. He willfully makes mistakes. He makes mistakes because he's trying to get a full experience that he knows he shouldn't be getting. You know, it's the whole forbidden fruit thing. It's the foil to the Bible, you know, where there's the forbidden fruit. Well, humanity's damned because you tasted the forbidden fruit. No, with Odysseus, only he's damned because he keeps tasting the forbidden fruit. But he keeps Hercules. The Hercules cycle is a tale of redemption. It is about making bad choices and coming back from them. So these are more authentic heroes to me. It doesn't necessarily have comedy, but it does have failure. I think acknowledging a human frailty and the ability to come back from it is what makes someone like an Odysseus or a Hercules a hero. Hercules, nobody's going to want to hear this. Hercules is the original Jesus prototype. He fails again and again, and he shows people, you failed, you can be like me. There is redemption in this life.
All right. Have you been watching The Mandalorian?
I haven't been watching it. Do I need to be watching? I feel that I need to be watching it.
It's really good. It's, you know, Star Wars has split in two, and terrible Star Wars is up on the big screen and amazing Star Wars is on the little screen. It's been that way for a very long time now. You know, they did six seasons. They did 5 seasons of Star Wars, The Clone Wars, which was an animated series. It takes place.
I remember that. Yeah.
It was great. As soon as Disney bought Lucasfilm, the very first thing they did was cancel that series because it ran on the Cartoon Network. Like season six was half finished and they canceled it because, you know, it was running on
it was pretty tight.
Yeah. It was running on a competitor's network. So then they finished season six a couple years later and sold it to Netflix. So the episodes that were in progress when the show got canceled did eventually get finished. Then over on Disney Plus, you know, when they moved everything over to their, not Disney Plus, Disney XD was the name of the channel. They came up with another show called Star Wars Rebels. And it takes place just before A New Hope.
Mm-hmm.
So even, you know, Luke Skywalker has like a walk-in cameo. He's a few years younger than we see him in Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope. But we see, you know, the final battle between Darth Maul and Ben Kenobi. And Ben Kenobi's an old man at this point. I mean, it was a really quality show. So the showrunner for those two shows was a guy named Dave Filoni, who was essentially George Lucas's Padawan. And when George Lucas, you know, released Star Wars into the care of Disney, he sent with it his two protectors of, you know, the source material. And they were Dave Filoni and Kathleen Kennedy.
Got it.
Kathleen Kennedy sold him out, stabbed him in the back, completely, you know, hired Rian Johnson and did this, you know, we're going to subvert all expectations thing and we're going to demean all the male characters and particularly Luke Skywalker. We're just going to rub his nose in the shit. And on the other track, you know, the Dave Filoni animated things have run their course, but then Jon Favreau, who's directed films for Disney, he and Dave Filoni got together and they came up with The Mandalorian.
So to some extent it's a response to these sort of trends that you're describing.
Well, you know, the Dave Filoni Star Wars track on the small screen has been in progress for a decade and a half. It's not new. It's not really a response. It's just that the two Star Wars have taken very distinct
paths,
and by now they have diverged so far the difference is, you know, impossible to miss.
Something for every taste.
Yeah, well, I know some people like the new Star Wars movies. I liked Rogue One well enough. It's about the only one I really hated. And what was it? The basically the soft reboot, Episode 7. What do they call it?
Yeah, and
what was that film
called?
I haven't
seen the last one or two. They all just kind of run together for me now. So I saw the one that was set on that desert planet that wasn't Tatooine.
Yeah.
So the other desert planet, which I thought was unnecessarily.
And the new Death Star.
Right. Yeah. So I saw that one. And I don't remember being offended by it, but I don't remember it that well. And that's probably telling.
It was directed by J.J. Abrams, who's really good at hitting the right emotional beats at the right time in the film.
Yep.
On that level, it worked. It was a competent film, and it had effects by Industrial Light and Magic, you know, so it looked really great, but the story was just, it made no sense.
Mm-hmm.
It was really incoherent and really disappointing. And then, you know, all these talented people had to come in and fill in around it with supplementary materials, you know, to make it make sense retroactively, you know, with new novels and things like that.
That's the one with the black stormtrooper who defects?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, got it.
Anyway, all of that came to mind because in the most recent episode of The Mandalorian, which was written by Dave Filoni, you know, the George Lucas Padawan, this series had been really good about making the main character conflicted and flawed and not getting everything right and, you know, triumphing in spite of making mistakes. And this most recent one was all fan service because it takes place on Tatooine.
Okay.
They go to the same bar where Han Solo shoots Greedo. I mean, it's fan service, like just stacked, you know, reference, you know, you recognize this. There was so much of that that they didn't really have room for the character
to
fail at anything.
Right.
It's a walkthrough for him. You know, it's like a video game level that he's playing for the 20th time. He knows everything that's coming. You know, he gets shot a couple times, but he's got his Mandalorian armor. It's no big deal. And that was the flaw for me. This one was just too much fan service. But every single episode before that had been great about not making the hero perfect, which is, you know, the main flaw of the new films up on the big screen is that Rey character who does everything perfectly the first time she tries, never fails at anything.
Right.
So can never learn anything.
Right. The Paragon.
Yep. Well, I hate to repeat the meme, but the Mary Sue.
Right.
That's the archetype.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Which, let's jump back in time, a very long time, back to the, you know, things we were talking about earlier. You know, the lectures that you're giving about the places you were moving through on that cruise ship. Other than Sinbad, what did you talk about with folks?
Oh, well, let's see. What were my lectures on this one? I've got them right here. I'll just take a look at them real quick. I gave a good talk on ancient extreme sports. That's a lot of fun. People like to use the word extreme a lot these days. It's taken on sort of a meaning of its own. But I take a look at, really the thing I focus on most is the history of chariot racing, which people got so heated about that the biggest riot in human history involving a sporting event took place in the 6th century AD in Byzantium, and they were called the Nika Riots. And basically this was two factions, the Blues and the Greens, who were so incensed over not just the racing but other social issues, had a riot in the Hippodrome, in the racetrack in what is now Istanbul, that the army had to get called in, and half the city was burned and 30,000 people were put to death in the stadium alone. So that's something I talked about, ancient extreme sports. I think that one was a lot of fun. I did a talk called Ethiopian Odyssey, which was my most travel log ever. It was basically a history of ancient and medieval Ethiopia as seen through the 2 weeks I spent backpacking around the country back in 2015. So I got to include a lot of pictures of my own. I did a talk called In Search of Atlantis, which basically starts with Plato and the things that he wrote about Atlantis. He's our first literary reference to Atlantis. And then I looked at the places where the Atlantis he describes might have been located. And then that and the Seven Wonders of the Ancient World, the Seven Voyages of Sinbad, the Odyssey, the gods and goddesses of ancient Egypt, gods and goddesses of ancient Greece and Rome. So that was pretty much it.
So you backpacked through Ethiopia in 2015?
I did, for a couple of weeks. Yeah, my brother was living over there at the time in Addis Ababa, so I had a hook to be able to go over there. So I flew into Addis Ababa, spent a couple days with him, and then went up to the north of the country and visited Aksum, which is where the Ark of the Covenant is supposed to be. Whenever you see one of these shows that talks about the Ark of the Covenant is at this church, you know, up in the wilds in northern Ethiopia. Well, I went to that church and went to the chapel where the Ark of the Covenant is supposed to be. They won't let you in. I mean, there's a monk and his acolyte are the only ones that can get into the building where it is.
Your face will melt if you look at the Ark. I know this from Indiana Jones. So.
Well, right, and you don't want to look at it anyway.
Yeah, they're doing you a favor.
But you might have seen pictures of some of these rock-cut churches where it's an entire church carved from a single block of rock. It's not a constructed church. It's sort of an excavated church. But it'll be an entire – and they've got 11 of these up in Lalibela, which is this town up in the mountains. So I visited these ancient, sacred, and historic sites around the country for a couple of weeks, yeah.
Well, unfortunately, because, you know, what I know about Ethiopia comes from mainstream media, I remember images from the famine, which was what, in the 80s?
Yeah, exactly.
And then, you know, my other source of images of Ethiopia is Black Hawk Down.
Yeah, and that's Somalia.
Oh, you're right. You're right. It is Somalia. Yes.
Yeah, that's so, Somalia.
Wow. Yeah, then my Ethiopia images are...
Is just the... And you know what? This is... I even... Funny, you should mention this. I start off my presentation about Ethiopia by saying most people's image of Ethiopia is based on images of famine that they periodically see on the news. It's a child sitting in the doorway to a hut covered with flies and dying. Yeah. And the whole time I was in Ethiopia, I never saw that. The country's got its problems. Overpopulation is one of its problems. Massive government corruption is another problem. These are problems, but the country is viable. Ethiopia has its own wineries. I drank Ethiopian wine when I was there. Most people wouldn't guess that. It has its own breweries. So I drank Ethiopian beer when I was there. It's culturally diverse, and one place to another, the people look different, the houses look different, the terrain and the plants look different. It is just such a fascinating country in so many ways. It was really, that was like an experience of a lifetime for me in a lot of ways. It really was a transformative experience. A lot of what I've written and a lot of what I've, the way I've thought about things since I was in Ethiopia exactly 4 years ago. I think it was probably on the plane back 4 years ago today. A lot of that was, it was very transformational experience and something that I will not ever regret having done.
And then your trip, you know, on the other side of the ocean ends in Dubai.
Yeah.
Dubai is a fascinating place. I mean, I've never been there, but it is fascinating to me in that it's sort of the anti-Saudi Arabia, whereas, you know, they both have oil wealth and Saudi Arabia just spends it and doesn't really prepare for the future. And Dubai is like leaning into the future hard.
Yeah, that's all true. Start with Dubai was always pretty rich. In like 1920, there were something like 7,000 pearl divers active in Dubai. 7,000 people diving for pearls in Dubai. So it was like the pearl capital of the world. So it was pretty wealthy in those days. But yeah, today it is extremely wealthy from oil money, but you can tell that the people are really trying to turn the city into a tourist attraction. Saudi Arabia is very, very much, I think the phrase that gets used to describe North Korea is the hermit kingdom, and Saudi Arabia is very much a hermit kingdom. They don't want people visiting other than Muslims for the Hajj, Muslims to go on the annual trip to Mecca. But Saudi Arabia is not accessible or user friendly, whereas the United Arab Emirates, seven principalities, of which Dubai is one, Abu Dhabi is another, they very, very much want foreigners to be coming in and spending money and going to the various attractions that they have there. Four of the tallest hotels in the world are in Dubai. The tallest building, the Burj Khalifa, which I went up when I was there, is in Dubai. The biggest shopping mall in the world is in Dubai. I was not impressed until I saw the aquarium with sharks swimming in it. Anytime I could see a shark swimming in a mall, it's a good day. It's visually stunning, and the architecture is so impressive. It's so monumental. And it's just coming straight up out of this teeming desert. It really, really feels like a science fiction city. It feels, if you flew into Dubai and somebody said, and you woke up and you had amnesia, and somebody said, you're landing on Mars. It's 2300. This is terraformed Mars, and this is the capital city of Mars. You'd believe it. You would absolutely believe that you were landing on Mars because the architecture is that alien and austere and imposing.
Now, a lot of people, they hold up Dubai as just the epitome of unsustainability in that it's all powered, you know, by oil and oil wealth. And you have things like, you know, this very hot desert where you have huge air-conditioned buildings and indoor ski slopes. You know, it's the epitome of unsustainability and, you know, failure to look at the future and the consequences of our actions in the present. And yet they are still very futuristic and future looking.
Right. You know what? We'll see in 20 years if it's unsustainable or not. A lot of that feels like sour grapes to me. You know, people in Dubai aren't saying that. I don't know. The people there are not stupid. Speaking as the citizen of a country that used to pride itself on building big, impressive things, I can hardly reproach somebody for having managed to build the tallest building in the world. You know, how is it that I can spin that in a negative way? I can't and I won't. Is it unsustainable? It's unsustainable if oil is the thing that's going to keep them going 10 or 15 or 20 years from now. But Russia is a powerhouse in many ways. And if as it becomes more economically viable, more and more Russians want to be places other than Russia. That's just a for example. A lot of Russian tourists in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and the Emirates. As people in countries like China and India that become more economically viable look for places to go. It's an attraction. They're trying to recast it as a wonder of the world. And it was very relevant to me that I was lecturing on the wonders of the world and then came to a place where people are building the tallest buildings that they can and putting aquariums and malls and putting ski slopes and shopping centers because that's what they're trying to do. So if they're sustainable, no, it's not going to be because of oil. Absolutely. If they're sustainable, it's going to be because it's a financial center and a tourist attraction. New York's Manhattan isn't viable because of all the oil they're pumping up out of it. There are plenty of places that are tourist attractions and financial centers that are viable, and it has nothing to do with expendable resources. So if they manage it right, I don't see any reason why it will be any less successful than New York City 20 or 50 years from now, oil or no oil.
Well, you know, if the Chinese Communist Party can't keep its hands off of Hong Kong, and in spite of themselves, they manage to, you know, strangle the golden goose.
Right.
There'll be a need for a new Hong Kong. So
yeah, but that's true. And you know what? And Dubai would take that role in a minute. I can guarantee it. Yeah.
That was Michael O. Varhola. And as he mentioned, he also... You know, the Geb comic strip, which I get paid to do by the a group called Progressives for Immigration Reform, it has its own website, but it's also on Instagram and Facebook. But Michael releases a PDF through the channels by which he sells his role-playing games and other books. And people, it's a pay-as-you-will PDF download. So Michael gets the you know, the high-resolution, the print-resolution version of the comic strip. And more people pay to download it than read it for free on the website. So, you know, when Michael proposed that method of distribution, it didn't make sense to me, but it works. And it works better than the website. We had a conversation after the one that you just heard in which we were talking about these things. And he said, you know, they have a saying at Skirmisher, that's his publishing company, that if you build it, they will not come. Websites aren't what they used to be. So he mentioned that the best translation for Sinbad the Sailor was Richard Francis Burton's translation. And, you know, I'd heard the name Richard Francis Burton, but it didn't mean a whole lot to me until I started searching around a little bit. Man, what a colorful character. He was Sir Richard Francis Burton, although the knighthood came... sort of begrudgingly from the crown, but he was born on the 19th of March, 1821, and died 79 years later on October 20th, 1890. He was a British explorer, geographer, translator, writer, soldier, orientalist, cartographer, ethnographer, spy, linguist, poet, fencer, and diplomat. He was famed for his travels and explorations in Asia, Africa, and the Americas, as well as his extraordinary knowledge of languages and culture, and that is an enormous understatement. According to one count, he spoke 29 European, Asian, and African languages. Basically, when he heard a language, he had to absorb it. Burton was a captain in the army of the East India Company, serving in India and later briefly in the Crimean War. Following this, he was engaged by the Royal Geographical Society to explore the east coast of Africa, where he led an expedition guided by locals and was the first European known to have seen Lake Tanganyika. He was also a fellow in the Royal Geographical Society and was awarded a knighthood in 1886. So that's all from Wikipedia, and it's all pretty, pretty vanilla. But, and I'll post this in the show notes for this episode, there is a New York Times piece on him from 1990 called "The Secret Agent Who Made the Pilgrimage to Mecca, Discovered the Kama Sutra, and Brought the Arabian Nights to the West" by Edward Rice. In the great comic novel, Augustus Carp Esquire by Himself Being the Autobiography of a Really Good Man, written pseudonymously by Sir Henry Howarth Bashford, a London doctor who was chief medical officer to the post office and honorary physician to King George VI, is, alas, virtually unknown in the United States. In the book, there is a lady who, after a lifetime of sexual excesses, takes to religions. She embraces all forms of Christianity and also Buddhism, Vedanta, and Islam. After all, she says, "I was always very good at embracing." The same may be said of the remarkable Sir Richard Burton, whose extreme interest in the erotic is memorialized by his translation of the Kama Sutra, and who was, perhaps simultaneously, a Roman Catholic, a Brahmin, a Sikh, and a Muslim. It ought to be enough for an Englishman to make the trip to the Grand Mosque of Mecca and into its most sacred precinct without being found out and slaughtered, but Burton did more than that. As an Indian officer, he helped, as they used to say, to keep the natives under. As an explorer, he searched for the source of the Nile. He looked for gold on the African coast, and while he was at it, in Brazil, he played the great game of a growing British Empire by spying on the Turks. As Edward Rice reminds us in his biography, Captain Sir Richard Francis Burton, he did much, much more. He was brilliant and courageous, and this made him enemies. The British grudgingly gave him a knighthood of a comparatively low order and sent him to brave the Bora, the violent wind that rakes the Adriatic, as consul in Trieste. They never knew how to exploit his talents, but they knew how to keep him out of mischief. The rough island story of the British, whom Mr. Rice seems to confuse with the English, is full of wasted genius. If Burton has prevailed over his enemies, it is posthumously. His written works, of which there are many, have survived. If our children know of Aladdin, Ali Baba, and Sinbad the Sailor, it is thanks to him. If their parents have mastered some of the sexual athletics described by Kama, the Hindu Cupid, it is, again, thanks to him. Burton's career, which was dedicated to piercing to the heart of the cultures of India and the Middle East, with Africa as a tidbit, was built on a kind of linguistic passion. He took the European tongues for granted. His work on the Portuguese poet Camões, sorry about the pronunciation, whom he first heard in the Portuguese colony of Goa while he was serving the British East India Company in India, would be enough to make any scholar's reputation, and he amassed a knowledge of nearly 30 more exotic ones. To be fair to the generality of British empire builders, the linguistic aspect of colonial service has always been well cultivated. But Burton's fanaticism in this field has been surpassed by only one other Victorian, George Borrow, the author of Lavengro. The language learning gifts need have little to do with intelligence, Professor Higgins in George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion says. The ability to master a new tongue in 2 weeks is the sure sign of stupidity, and one is not surprised to find Burton frequently foolish, particularly in his racial prejudices. Called a white nigger, which the New York Times was willing to print back in 1990, called a white nigger himself because of his preference for Oriental dress over tight trousers and red tunic of the 19th century British Army, he was bitter about African blacks. In the Kipling manner, surely a shadow of Burton appears in Kim, he deployed the, quote, "all along of dirtiness, all along of mess," close quote, of the subject peoples. The darker the skin, the worse the filth, according to him. His travel writings are full of horror at disgusting food, foul lodgings, overrich insect life. He transcends Arab squalor by concentrating on the Quran and bathing in the pure white light of the Islamic revelation. when at the end of a life that was longer than it had any right to be, he retired to pray. He was not, as his cradle Catholic wife Isabel thought, addressing the Christian God. He was probably reciting, "There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet," which seals a Muslim's salvation. And yet, in the 19th century manner, he had grave doubts about God's existence. If God was up there, it was because the devil was down here. He saw enough of the diabolic. If the West is becoming orientalized, it is perhaps only in the sense that it is learning from scimitared marauders, Indian infanticides, capital judgments uttered by religious leaders against men like Salman Rushdie. The eternal female didn't exactly draw Burton upwards, rather the opposite, but she assured him of certain certainties, of which sex was one. Even at Mecca, during the sacred sermon which closes the Hajj, the greater pilgrimage to Mecca, a girl flirted with him. It is comforting to feel that the tradition of the sleeping dictionary, still powerful while I served a dying empire in barbarous places in this century, ensured for Burton both colloquial competence and the ecstasies of coitition, often in outlandish forms. He had a great deal to say about Indian, Iranian, Arab, and Somali sexual culture, and he deplored such initiation rites as clitorectomy and infibulation, or the sewing up of the labia. He himself, entering Islam, was circumcised at a mature age, and he writes frankly about the consequent odoration of the gland. He was writing these things at the wrong time, when a teeming life of British debauchery was masked by Grundy-esque hypocrisy. His translations of the Kama Sutra and the Scented Garden are not works we can imagine Queen Victoria reading, and his rendition of the Arabian Nights, an incredible scholarly performance, is not really a book for children. What his wife burned of his many manuscripts after his death, according to her, his ghost appeared three times to order wholesale destruction, we shall never know. The writings we have of his are undeniably important. Some of them are profitable to publishers still, but Burton was always a poor man. Whatever the British establishment thought of him, he was a hero to ordinary people, in Islam as well as Christendom. We don't seem to be able to produce this kind of tough scholar anymore. T.E. Lawrence, whose Arabic was not all that good, was a mere ghost of the Rambo-esque Burton, broad-chested and fierce-eyed. The fine body, when it was stripped for burial, was found to be a network of knife strokes. He suffered from all the tropical diseases, which he tried to keep down with Pantagruelian drinking. He had syphilis, of course, but that was cancelled out by malaria. The will was supreme and got the better of the body. Mr. Rice's telling of the tale, an odyssey, really, of the travail and travels of this body and of the unquenchable urge to get at the truth of life that rode above the tale, is first class. It excuses those of us too lazy or too television-soaked to get at Burton himself by giving us a terse summary of a strange life. Besides, we might find Burton's prose difficult, and I'm going to skip over the passages that demonstrate that. Unsafe for a pilgrim. "There at last it lay," wrote Burton, in a mood of exultation, realizing the plans and hopes of many and many a year. Before him was the huge square catafalque, the Kabbalah, the sacred house of God, the Beit al-Allah. It was a huge cube of masonry and was the holiest center of Islam, in fact, the center of the earth. As a man who is now a haji, Burton wanted to enter the shrine. The door of the building is not at ground level, but some 7 feet above it. He was lifted up by the guards, and then he was inside being questioned by several officials, dark-looking Meccans. Having satisfactorily answered them about his name, nation, and other particulars, he was allowed to continue. There was nothing more simple than the interior of this celebrated building. It was constructed of slabs of fine marble. The floor was made of white and colored marble in a checkerboard pattern. It was considered disrespectful to look at the ceiling. "Unsafe for a pilgrim," Burton remarked, but he did, noting the crossbeams and their size and the type of wood. Finally, after the customary prayers, was passed through the door by the brawny Meccan guards and felt free. "Voila, Effendi," said Muhammad ambiguously. "Thou hast escaped well. Some men have left their skins behind." So in response to the video portion of the conversation with Michael Ovarhola, Pantalones Frescos posted, "Interesting guy. I remember a previous interview you did with him about role-playing games. Love the lecture cruising gig. He seems to be enjoying his life." To which I responded, "He's making the most of the time allotted to him, that's for sure." And I guess the same could certainly be true of Richard Francis Burton, despite all the drinking. All right, well, I think I'm going to leave it there, mostly because I've cut it out, but my voice keeps cracking. If there is a topic you would like me to engage with for future podcasts, do let me know. My email address is kmo@c-realm.com. All right. We'll talk to you again soon, if not before Christmas, and if it's important to you, happy Christmas, or Merry Christmas, as we say in the United States. Stay well.